Thank you. Is this on? I'd like to thank the organizers of the conference for inviting me to give this talk. We've heard many exciting new ideas this week that are developing in recent years. I'm going to talk about something, an old idea that has not been developed in the last few years, which is the problem of the ground state wave function in BFSS matrix theory. This is based on work in progress with Yingxuan Lin, who's also here for the whole program, that should appear pretty soon. So I'd like to begin with a remark on the motivation. It's become increasingly evident that to understand the semi-classical regime of gravity, especially to address puzzles with black holes using holography, it requires us to understand genuinely strongly coupled large and gauge theories. And by genuinely strongly coupled, I mean not just having some toothed parameter that is of order one, but have to sometimes certain quantities you can compute in theories where the toothed coupling is large, but the dynamics are not quite the kind of the sort we want, which is more like the n equals 4 super annulus and strong coupling. So we would like a clean setup to address some of these strong coupling questions and more seriously, Lorentzian questions. So for that purpose, I'm going to revisit an old story that the younger people are perhaps not so familiar with, and the more senior people might have forgotten about. And that is the duality between the 16 supercharged SUM matrix quantum mechanics and a particular background of M theory or type 2A string theory. I'm going to give a brief overview of this from the perspective of the ADS-CFT, which was first, there was some confusion about this when it was first proposed by BFSS and was clarified in the, along the lines of ADS-CFT correspondence by Balasubramanian and Gawakumar-Larsen and by Suskin and by Polchinski. So the quantum mechanics is just the dimension reduction of your favorite maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory to 0 plus 1 dimensions. I'm going to work with the Hamiltonian formalism, where these Xi's are n by n matrices, traceless, and Pi is the conjugate momenta, and these thetas are the fermions. And the dual of this is just the lift of, well, if you want to view this as a background of M theory, it's an 11-dimensional lift of a type 2A string theory geometry, which is just the near horizon limit of N D0 brains, the supergravity solution of N D0 brains. This lifts to a pure geometry in, in M theory, which is a solution to vacuum Einstein equation. It's a plane wave, but compactified in such a way that here this Ward factor F of R in front of dy squared, which f of r goes to n over r to the seventh. This thing is written in 11d Planck units in such a way that as you go to asymptotic infinity in the spatial R9 direction, the y, which parameterizes the circle, becomes null. So it's an asymptotically null compactified space-time, but anywhere at finite distance, it's just a space-like compactified. And that's the geometry. Now let me describe sort of the intuition and kind of what sort of questions we'll be interested in here. So the bulk could be viewed this way. Here I'm drawing this R9, and then there's a circle, the M3 circle that's fibered over it. So you can view this either from the M3 perspective or from the 2A perspective. At long distance, you have a very stringy, weakly coupled, a very stringy type 2A string theory. The curvature is large, but the string coupling is very weak. As you enlarge the N regime, large N limit, if you go a little bit toward the origin, where the R is less than N to the 1/3, but bigger than N to the 1/7, you get to the weakly curved type 2A string theory regime. If you go a bit further toward the interior, you discover that the M theory circle opens up, and you get 11-dimensional supergravity limit of M theory. And then at the center, there's a Planckian curvature singularity. So from the quantum mechanics perspective, you can study the Coulomb branch moduli space, and you look at the limit where the eigenvalues, the matrices Xi's are approximately mutually commuting, and you can diagonalize them. The eigenvalue, you take one eigenvalue and probe the moduli space, you'll discover the scaling regime where if R is bigger than n to 1/3, the effective TOF coupling is weak, and you can do reliable weak coupling computation there. And then you go into the strong TOF coupling regime. Surprisingly, the regime where you can do reliable weak coupling computation is a very stringy regime in type 2A string theory. So makes it hard to check this duality. If you want to explore the kind of weakly curved type 2A regime, you are in the regime where the effective TOF parameter is strong in from the matrix theory perspective. And really, the interesting thing about M theory, 11D M theory, will require you to explore beyond the TOF scaling regime, where the TOF parameter will now scale with some power of N. So the sort of question you might be interested in, for instance, one of the simplest questions you can ask is, what happens if you throw a D0 brain to the system and let it scatter? The reason I pick D0 is because for this particular asymptotic geometry, the D0 brains are only things that can travel to infinity. So these are the only asymptotic states, or the bound state of D0 brains. If you try to address this question from the point of view of the gauge quantum mechanics, you'll be throwing an eigenvalue. You can make a wave packet of eigenvalue and let it probe this Coulomb branch moduli space, let it scatter. But then there's a ground state wave function. It was understood, at least qualitatively, that this ground state wave function was spread to the size that's precisely this R of order n to the 1/3. And that's the regime where the effective, at least the naive effective TOF coupling is strong. And it's not really clear what happens when the eigenvalue enters this region and interacts with this very complicated ground state wave function. And that's where you expect something very simple happening in the bulk, but you can describe this D0 brain using DBI, effective action. But here, it's not so clear what's going on. And that's the thing we'd like to understand. And furthermore, this duality has great potential promise, because you can use it to study scattering of, say, D0 brains in type 2A or gravitons in M theory. And in principle, if you can solve the quantum mechanics, you'll be able to address, compute such scattering amplitudes at arbitrary energy scale, it seems. But that obviously seems to be a difficult problem, because we don't even know what happens to the propagation of a single eigenvalue, let alone to actually compute the scattering of them in this presence of this ground state wave function. So the previous computation that was done at the end of last century amounts to this. So you throw the eigenvalue, sort of let it scatter against the remaining SUM minus 1 block of this matrix theory, which sits in its ground state. But this computation can only be done in a perturbative manner if the impact parameter is very large and velocity is sufficiently small in the weak coupling regime. But actually, there's even complication even with that, the naive perturbative computation. So I should say that this amounts to, from the bulk perspective, some computation of the scattering D0 brains in a very, very stringy regime where we don't really know how to compare precisely. The perturbative computation suffers from IR divergences. This is what you expect with any massless quantum field theory in one dimension. As far as I know, in the previous computations, this IR divergence was kind of simply ignored by some hand-waving arguments. But I can think it cannot actually be ignored. If you take this into account, it would already, even in the perturbative regime, you would mess up the analytic structure of the naive perturbative expansion. For instance, you can get some contribution to the effective potential that imitates some fractional loop order contribution. the real interesting thing that we'd like to understand, ultimately, is the black holes in this story. You can make a black hole in the bulk geometry by turning on some temperature, and there'll be a horizon, some supergravity solution. This black hole is, of course, non-extremal, it will decay through emitting Hawking radiation. But the only, as I already mentioned, the only Hawking quanta that can escape to infinity are the D0 brains. So the gravitons, if it's emitted, will be bounced back by this geometry. This black hole actually has some kind of nice properties. It has exponentially long lifetime as opposed to Schwarzschild black holes in asymptotic flat space time. So it's in a way more stable than Schwarzschild black holes in asymptotic flat space, then you might think you have a better chance of understanding it. And I would like to understand the state of this black hole from the quantum mechanics as some kind of metastable states. I'll describe the Hilbert space or speculate on the structure of the Hilbert space of the quantum mechanics in a second. But if you can describe these metastable states, understand how they decay, you will understand exactly how to describe the squawking radiation from the quantum mechanics perspective. The Hilbert space of the matrix quantum mechanics looks like the following. I should emphasize that the Hilbert space I'm talking about here for the matrix quantum mechanics is not the analog of n equals 4 supermiles on the 3 sphere. It's the analog of n equals 4 supermiles on T3. And there's a big difference there in the spectrum. So first of all, in this metric theory, it's understood that there's a unique normalizable supersymmetric ground state, which is going to be the subject of study here. And on top of that, there's a continuum of scattering states. This is already something that's kind of counterintuitive. Usually, in the most simplest quantum mechanics models, you'll cook up with the ground state is either that ground state is normalizable and then there's a gap, or the ground state is not normalizable and there's no gap. But this is a situation where you have a normalizable ground state and no gap. There's a continuum of scattering states, obviously. Well, not completely obvious, but that's kind of a standard story where there's no essentially means that there's no quantum correction to this moduli space. But we don't even know. I don't know, and I never talked to some people, and I would never obtained any kind of answer to this. Whether there are any finite non-zero energy normalizable energy eigenstates at all in this theory. And if there are, I mean, the hint that there probably aren't such things is because the black holes in the bulk will decay away. But if there are such things, it means that these black holes could have Planckian remnants. So it'd be interesting to figure out the answer to this, even though the answer is probably negative. But in any case, there must be lots of long-lived metastable states to account for the microstates of the black hole, and those are things we ultimately would like to understand. Our understanding of the ground state, as far as I know, I summarized in this slide. First of all, there's a highly non-trivial index computation that suggests that there's a unique normalizable ground state. The reason it's a non-trivial computation is because the spectrum is continuous. There's no gap. So if you compute trace minus 1 to the f e to the minus beta h, the answer depends on beta. The computation is usually done easily in the small beta limit, high temperature limit, where the model reduced to the, not temperature, I mean, this is the supersymmetric boundary condition in Euclidean time. But there was a beautiful paper by Moore, Nekrasov, and Shashvili that did this computation using localization. But the answer is not an integer. So there's a subtle boundary term you have to take into account to account for this difference between beta goes to 0 and beta goes to infinity, explained in the nice paper by Sethi and Stern. And eventually, you do get 1 as the answer in a rather non-trivial way. The wave function is expected to spread to size n to the 1/3 in units set by G and Mills, as I mentioned earlier. But there's not very much precise understanding of that, as far as I know. There's going to be, importantly, we can understand the precise asymptotic expansion of the wave function in the SU2 case. I'm going to mostly be following this approach in this paper by Frohlich, Graf, Hessler, Hoppe, and Yao from 99. And that's going to be the method I'm going to use to explore this in the SUN case. And finally, there exists a proposal for the asymptotic expansion for this wave function in the case when n is 3 or higher by Hoppe and the collaborators. I think the proposal was not correct, and for reasons I'll explain. I'll present a new proposal. So that's going to be the main result of this talk. So first of all, for those of you who have not really thought much about this, let me say a few words on why this is a hard problem. The matrix quantum, unlike the example of the x squared, y squared potential Zohar talked about mentioned the other day, this is much different because of the non-existence of the gap in the spectrum. So the matrix quantum mechanics here is strongly coupled at low energies. The Yang-Mills coupling has dimension 3/2, and the effective Yang-Mills coupling is strong at low energies. And we're asking a question about the lowest energy state. If you think about this wave function, if you think you can solve all problems of quantum mechanics from your undergraduate quantum mechanics class, this wave function, when you quantize the fermions, is a wave function that has 2 to the 8 times n squared minus 1 components, internal components, and each component is a function of 9 times n squared minus 1 coordinates. So even in SU2 case, it's unfeasible to put this on the computer. Why is this interesting? I've already mentioned some hints, but I think two important reasons that will be interested in studying properties of this ground state wave function, not just its existence, is that the ground state wave function, in some sense, is what creates a semi-classical geometry in the bulk. When this eigenvalue does not enter the ground state wave function, you're in a very stringy regime. If you're able to somehow understand the Wolschi string theory in that regime, perhaps in pure spinner formalism, that would be nice, but we don't understand that yet. And we'd like to be able to explore the regime that looks more like the semi-classical spacetime. In particular, these eigenvalues, which in quantum mechanics, obviously in a weak coupling regime, are based on a non-relativistic dispersion relation. But somehow, when they enter the strong coupling regime and interact with the ground state wave function, that turns into a relativistic particle that probes the bulk geometry. So this is a little bit like the Fermi theorem, and we'd like to understand that precisely in this context. And it's also a starting point toward constructing this metastable states. Obviously, they would like to know how to describe precisely in the quantum mechanics. So I'm going to be talking about the solution to this equation, Q cycle 0, where Q represents the 16 supercharges. The method I'm going to adopt is the method studied by these people in the SU2 case. But there will be some important differences, as I'll point out shortly. The asymptotic expansion near the moduli space. By this, I mean you have to start somewhere, strong coupling problem. So you expand around the limit where you are close to the Coulomb branch moduli space, where the 9, say, bosonic matrices are approximately commuting, and the eigenvalues are well separated, and you expand around that. As I'll explain shortly how this is done explicitly, neither the existence nor the uniqueness of the solution will be a priori guaranteed by just staring at the equation, but there's some interesting information you can extract out of it. In the SU2 case, this asymptotic expansion can be completely determined. In the SUN case, it will turn out this equation. Sorry? Asymptotic in 1 over the separation of these eigenvalues, this in a second. In the SUN case, you'll see that these, just by expanding this equation themselves, is not quite enough to determine the asymptotic form, even the asymptotic form of the wave function. And we need some additional physical inputs to guide us through this problem, knowing what we expect to get in the end. So I'll separate this into a few steps. The first step is we need to, I like to do this in Hamiltonian formalism. As I mentioned earlier, so you might think this problem of doing the asymptotic expansion is kind of like doing the compute some effective action on the Coulomb branch. There's a crucial difference here, which is that the usual computation, in that computation, the IR divergence that, as I mentioned, has to be cured non-perturbatively. And it's not quite clear how to do that in a systematic way. There will be no such problem. I'm just playing with some differential equations. First step is that I wrote this Hamiltonian in terms of these matrices, which rotate under the SUN. But eventually, I'll be studying wave functions that are SUN invariant, because SUN is gauged in this case. I'm going to remove the gauge redundancy and separate near the moduli space, I'm going to separate the general variable into some light degrees of freedom and heavy degrees of freedom in this way. So after some SUN rotation, can put the xi's into a form that's diagonal plus some off-diagonal stuff. And I'm going to consider a limit where the diagonal eigenvalues, or not eigenvalues, the diagonal entries, are somewhat far separated so that these off-diagonal modes are heavy. To do that, I have to put some constraints to ensure that this Ra is the same as this xa vector here. I have to put some constraints to ensure that these off-diagonal modes are really genuinely transverse to the valley of the potential, but that can be done in a rather straightforward manner, but you have to be careful and do the same thing for the fermions, just separate in this way. And I'm going to assume that this separation of these eigenvalues in R9 are sufficiently large and can do an expansion in 1 over the distance separation between each pair of the eigenvalues. So I'm do an extension in 1 over the sort of overall separation of the eigenvalues. These Qs, these off-diagonal modes, are going to be confined by this value of the potential. The potential will, the steepness of the potential is proportional to RAB, the difference, the distance between these eigenvalues. And Q QAB will scale like this, r to the minus 1/2. So I'm going to rescale this q into a variable y, which now would be of order 1. Step 2, I'm going to expand this equation out. So first of all, I had to change the variable from the xi's and the thetas into these y's, which are the off-diagonal modes, and the r's, which are the diagonal modes, and also the fermions. If you expand them out, you can just find some non-trivial expression like this. The general structure is that the first order, which goes like r to the 1/2, actually, the supercharge is something that only involves the off-diagonal modes, essentially. I mean, the dependence on the diagonal, on the light modes is algebraic. And then the differential equation involving the light modes will come at the next order. So I'm going to consider an asymptotic expansion of the wave function in this form, where psi 0 plus psi 1, psi 2, and so forth. The expansion parameter will be 1 over r to the 3/2, which is really the same as GMUs, but the dimension is combination of GMUs with r. I'm going to assume for now that the leading term is some homogeneous function under the overall risk scaling of all the RAs simultaneously. And there's some scaling exponent kappa. I'd like to know what that kappa is. So if you do that for the equation, obviously it kind of separates into these equations at various orders in 1 over r, or 1 over r to 3/2. And we'll analyze these equations. So let's look at the first equation. This equation will say that the off-diagonal modes are in their ground state to the first order. Note that this first equation does not determine the dependence of the wave function on light modes, and that's the thing I'm after. So for that, we have to look at the second equation. The second equation says, the second equation depends on psi 0, the first order wave function, and also the next order wave function. We don't know this yet. So we have to, we can't just directly solve psi 0 by looking at this equation, but what we can do is to project. So here, this p0 is a projector onto the functions, the space of the zero eigenspace of this zeroth order supercharge, which just means you project all the off-diagonal degrees of freedom onto the ground state. So if you do this projector, it will kill anything that's obtained by acting q0 on something, because q0 will always excite some off-diagonal modes, and you're left with the equation just for psi 0. So that would be a question for the leading. That would be a non-trivial question that will tell us something about the dependence on light degrees of freedom of the leading asymptotic wave function. So it turns out that after, this expression of Q1 may look a little messy here. But actually, if you look at it, for example, this term looks kind of a mess. But there's a theta, which is off-diagonal mode here. If you take this acting ground state, you will always excite some off-diagonal modes, either another ground state or excite some off-diagonal fermion modes. So if you take this and act on psi 0, you will never it will never be projected back to the ground state. So it will just get killed. So actually, most of these terms will go away once you look at that equation, p0, q1, psi 0 equal to 0. The result is actually, after some simple redefinition of the wave function by some measure factor, this is due to our choice of coordinate system, you get an equation that really describes sort of a zero energy state of some a system of n-1 free superparticles on R9 and with 16 supersymmetries. This essentially reduced a free problem, and you might be surprised why the solution of a free problem can be complicated. First of all, this problem by itself will have many solutions, obviously, but only one of them corresponds to the real thing. I have to figure out which one. Cannot fix by just looking at this equation by itself, obviously, for the reason I just said. You have to impose some additional constraints based on what we really know about the ground state wave function. So we need to, for example, there's still the residual Sn permutation symmetry on the n eigenvalues. And when you expand near the moduli space, we know the ground state wave function must be SO9 rotation invariant. So we want to impose that. If you do this in n equals 2 case, in SU2 case, the answer is fixed. I'll review that in a second. It's not fixed when n is greater than 2, and we need some additional physical inputs. We'll discuss this explicit solution in a second. If we have the psi 0, Then we can do the same thing for the next equation. We can, again, do this projection onto the ground state in the off-diagonal sector. So for the second equation, if we do that projection, it will allow us to solve for the next order correction, so the asymptotic wave function, and so on and so forth. It turns out that the next order is particularly simple. I'll write down some algebraic expression of psi 1 in terms of psi 0. But for psi 2, you have to do a lot more work, because in that case, it turns out you have to solve some non-trivial kind of first order Dirac-like equation for these superparticles. OK, so the property that I would like to impose, which is, at first it sounds obvious, but actually, the more you think about it, at least to me, the more I think about it, the less obvious it is in this context, which is that you expect this leading asymptotic wave function to have the property that if the eigenvalues fall into two clusters that are separated far away on the Coulomb branch, then the wave function should factorize in that limit into the wave function for this cluster here, the wave function of this cluster here, and the wave function for the relative bosonian and fermionic coordinates, which is essentially proportional to the SU2 answer. Because that one is, it obeys this equation for the free superparticles and essentially is fixed by symmetry in a way that I'll talk about in just a second. And because we're looking for the leading asymptotic expansion, we'd like to have this psi 0 to follow as slow as possible at large distances. Now, a word of caution is that there could be more than one branches in asymptotic expansion. And the other branches, there could be other branches that follow faster in 1 over r, and that's not visible from this way of solving the equation. And so ultimately, that's something that we would have to understand. So in the SU2 case, which is worked out in this paper, the moduli space is just, the bosonic part of moduli space is just R9. You have this relative coordinate between the two eigenvalues on R9. And then the fermionic degrees of freedom, there are 16 fermions, theta, alpha. If you quantize them, you get 2 to the 8, 256 states. If you ask how these states transform under SO9 rotation on 16 fermions, it branches into these representations of SO9. The only one that can form a singlet, we demand the eventual wave function to be a singlet, the only one can form a singlet by combining with a bosonic coordinate is this 44, which is the traceless symmetric tensor of SO9. The answer, the free wave function, the leading sort of psi 0, which is supposed to be the wave function for free superparticle on R9/16, is of this form, where this ij denotes the 44 of these 256 states coming out of quantization of the fermions, and then the coefficient is r hat, this is a unit vector in the unit vector, ith component of the position on R9, divided by 1 over distance to 9th power. These components, each of the components is a harmonic function. Notice that it's a little different from the usually think of a scalar harmonic function, which is 1 over r to the 7th, you have to take two derivatives here. okay, that was the SU2 case. Now I'm going to propose the answer for the SUN case. Before that, I should say that even though this is a free problem, the answer was not completely obvious. One important thing you have to keep in mind is the constraint that we're factoring out the center mass degrees of freedom. So it's not really m particles that you're treating with. It has to deal with the m-1 relative coordinates. It's not completely obvious how to write down these kind of harmonic-like wave functions that are also involved in the fermion degrees of freedom and also in the singlet of SO9. But there's actually a natural guess that's consistent with all the constraints that I described earlier. And that takes the following form. I can write down a more precise formula, but it's more illuminating to just draw a picture. So here, this leading asymptotic wave function I'm proposing here is going to be a sum over the following terms. Each term is described by a tree. That's just a convenient way to summarize the structure here. I take, say, here in the example of 5 of these particles, this n equals 5 SU5 case. There are only m-1 independent relative coordinates, but we'll talk about 5 particles anyway. I take 2 of these particles, and I have a two-body wave function in their relative coordinates. And then I take the center mass of this system, which I now view as a bound state, with this guy here. I take the relative position between center mass here and the coordinate, center mass coordinate here and the coordinate here, but weighed by their, you know, the number of particles in each quote unquote bound state. So this is going to be a sum of just the product of two body wave functions that's described in this way. And so this will have the property that if some cluster, you know, if this bunch into two clusters, say this group and this group, then the wave function will factorize into the relative SU2 wave function multiplied by that of each cluster, but with a potentially non-trivial coefficient, which I call here C3,2, meaning there are three particles in this cluster and two particles in this cluster. I don't know how to determine these Cs a priori. These are some constants that I don't have an argument to determine a priori, but this is structure I would expect. So this is just a picture that explains what I just said in Word. So there's some, once again, there's some precise formula for this, and you can easily check that this is an exact solution to this equation of the free supercharge I described earlier. It falls off like R to minus 9 times n minus 1 power at large distances on the overall rescaling. That probably isn't a priori obvious. It's perhaps anticipated, but it's different from the previous proposal by Hoppe. In fact, the Hoppe's proposal, which I won't explain in detail for now, but I'm happy to explain after the talk, fall off like R to the 14th power faster than the one I'm proposing here. Again, these coefficients here are so far ambiguous. I don't know how to fix it a priori. Be nice to understand that. And once we know psi 0, we can compute psi 1. There's some explicit formula. I just want to point out the structure here, that psi 1 has a structure where you take psi 0, described by this term, described by this tree, and you excite the offline modes that are kind of that sits on the links or bounds between a triple of these particles. And you can go on to compute psi 2 and so forth. But we haven't computed psi 2. Now that's the main result, and that's a starting point for the asymptotic expansion of the ground state wave function. Obviously there are many things to be understood here. Ultimately, what is this good for? I just want to summarize a few points. I think we need to revisit the D0 and graviton scattering computation in the matrix quantum mechanics. Taking into account the effect of this ground state wave function. As I commented on earlier, even in a perturbative regime, this is important, and it will actually give a contribution that imitates fractional loop order effects. So there was this famous computation of the graviton or D0 brain effective potential as an expansion in powers of the velocity. Starting at the velocity to the eighth order, that's no longer protected by supersymmetry. In fact, there was a famous puzzle first pointed out by Becker and Becker, where they tried to compare this with the R to the fourth correction in M theory and found disagreement. Of course, now I understand there's no reason why they would agree to begin with, but already at this order, this contribution of the ground state wave function will completely mess up that naive perturbative computation. And hopefully, by understanding this asymptotic expansion, we will be able to say some non-trivial things about that. We'd like to understand how the eigenvalues that falls into this big ground state wave function sees the semi-classical spacetime. And this is some reminiscent of the structure of a tensor network. I don't know what to say precisely, but this sounds, smells something interesting might be going on there. And I would like to build the excited states. Just a final comment on the philosophy. It was an old idea that we can probe the space-time in this matrix model using eigenvalues. To me, this is much more intuitive than trying to probe the bulk using correlation functions in the CFT, but just because the bulk is not emergent, it's already there in the Coulomb branch moduli space. So perhaps this is a better kind of setup where you want to address questions related to black holes. Is the horizon really visible from the gauge theory perspective? Well, you can just look at excited states and see if there's what happens when eigenvalues fall into the wave function. So that's basically all I have to say. And with that, some remark by two prominent physicists that I heard a few years ago. Thank you.
So were you summing over just cyclic permutations of those trees or all permutations?
All the trees have different topologies.
So all permutations as well.
Permutation as well.
Not just cyclic structure.
Yes, yes.
So it doesn't exactly look like a mirror. Or,
what?
It doesn't look that much like tensor networks then.
I don't have anything precise to say. That was only a.
And can you follow up your program without determining those C's?
Yes, you can. You can just once you have the size zero, you can just keep computing things. But you won't be able to determine the C's, I think, just by looking at asymptotic expansion. So you need some. I mean, in principle, of course, you know there's a unique solution, but that would require you to really sum up that entire series and see that wave function is smooth and so forth. That seems to be kind of impossible to do just directly using asymptotic expansion. So one needs some additional inputs. Perhaps there's some way to compare these with some expansion value of some quantities in the ground states, but I don't know yet how to actually determine these coefficients. Naively one might guess they're all one, but I don't think that need to be the case.
Just to understand, I think you probably said this, but I didn't catch it. You were doing an asymptotic expansion in the separation of the eigenvalues at fixed n?
At fixed n, yes. N need not be large. N can be 2, 3, 4.
Aren't we more interested in the asymptotic expansion at large n?
Yes, and this method does not is not special to. Oh, wait, sorry, you told me about things like 1 over n expansion? Or? I'm not doing that. N is fixed for me, so I'm just expanding in.
But if we want to sort of understand what's going on, you know, in the sense of holography or whatever, it's in the large n limit that we expect to recover some kind of space-time. So
yes, absolutely. Let me make one comment on how this might be helpful. It might be helpful. I'm not completely sure. Which is that. Before, if you didn't know any structure about the ground state wave function, you expect that it has some perhaps simple behavior at distance large compared to n to the 1/3, but becomes a mess when it's small compared to n to the 1/3. But here, this tree structure seems to indicate the possibility of that is, you know, asymptotic expansion here, each term I'm writing, might still be valid when this separation between a pair of eigenvalues is just large compared to 1, but not necessarily large compared to n to the 1/3. It's not obvious which one is right, but if that's the case, it will allow you to kind of go deeper into this naively would be strong coupling regime. So you can actually try to calculate things like, let's say if you pretend this, I mean, obviously this leading asymptotic form of the wave function is not normalized by someone. It blows up in the interior, which has to be corrected. But if you just take this as an approximation, you might try to study what happens when a particle just, you know, goes in at short distances and, not short, some intermediate distances and interact with the ground state wave function, do a standard scattering computation, and see what happens. Maybe you'll find some agreement with the bulk picture, maybe not. So that's the, but there's something that I think should be looked at.
So something that comes up a lot is this notion that you can use eigenvalues as probes of the geometry. But I think at a certain point, this becomes very approximate and not well defined. I mean, the most obvious thing is the x's in the different directions don't commute; that they have large commutators of the fluctuations.
Yes,
and so, you know, it would be.
Let me clarify that a little bit. Of course, here I'm talking about making asymptotic state, which is described by wave packet of one of the in the limit when one of the eigenvalues is far separated and off-diagonal modes are sitting in their ground state. Of course, when this thing travels into the interior and interacts with wave function, it becomes very complicated. And we need to understand what's actually going on there. So it's not obvious, indeed, it's not obvious that the space-time is actually there. It's possible you can see it, but I'm not sure. But I think, but at least it's more intuitive than trying to probe with correlators. That's all I mean.
A lot of papers are written using this notion, but correlators are gauge invariant, and this really it would be nice if there was some sharp notion of a probe.
Yes, I agree. So.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank you again.